Namo myoho renge kyo, namo myoho renge kyo, namo myoho renge kyo. Hi everyone, good to see you here. Good, thank you for your practice, for your steadfastness, yeah? I hope this finds you in good health, secure. We are in the BDK translation of one of Kumarajiva's Chinese translations of the Lotus Sutra. A lot has happened in this story so far, in this assembly. We are firmly into the second half of the Lotus Sutra now. We're about to start chapter 16. So what's happened so far? Well, we've assembled every manner of student of Buddhism, of enlightenment, of awakening possible. Lay people, monks, men, women, every conceivable mental condition from the cosmos to samsaric earthly beings, yes? Indicative of all the sutras, it kind of describes the mental capacities and levels of study that this current teaching is meant to reach. And in the Lotus, it's pretty comprehensive. Pretty much we could say just all sentient minds and non-sentient minds, really. And Shakyamuni has announced that he's about to start a teaching that he's never taught before. In fact, of all the teachings he's taught and will ever teach on the Dharma, this is the ultimate. This is the one. This is the... maybe you've been waiting for it, maybe you didn't expect it, doesn't matter. This is the method for self-enlightenment. Surprised a lot of people. People have been following him for 40 years or so, or maybe 10 years, maybe just a year. But in all of his teachings, in all of these students of his teaching, well, this is a pretty big announcement. What do you mean? What's that about? What do you do? And, you know, I've made something in the previous videos on this particular translation of the fact that there are many students of the learning school, the Sravaka school, the Pratyekabuddha school, the Arhat, thinking that they've achieved full enlightenment. And, you know, Nichiren talks about this too, but Shakyamuni, of course, they're his teachings, has been admonishing those lower schools as you're never going to get to Buddhahood. So for them to be a bit incredulous at this moment in this teaching, he kind of brought that on himself, right? He had good reason for doing it, don't get me wrong, but as we read this, we might wonder, you know, why are these people so incredulous? Why are they asking for his permission? Why do they keep wanting his prediction? Well, he made predictions before, and his prediction said, ain't for you, you're never going to get there. You'll learn a lot from this, but, so what was that? In that, you know, culture was different 2,700 years ago, yeah? So maybe that was, people were used to that carrot, right? If your teacher, if your mentor told you, you'll never get there, was that somehow an incentive to just try harder? We don't really know for sure, but it certainly was part of his skillful means, yeah? I mean, why would you continue studying with a teacher for 40 years and consistently be told, yeah, you'll achieve a lot, but you'll never be fully enlightened. I mean, what were the Arhats thinking? kind of lends a different thought consideration when 8,000 of them get up and at the beginning and just go, we've heard this before, and they leave, right? But Shakyamuni wasn't impressed. Remember in the H. Kern translation, he's translated as saying, what, you know, he didn't say a word, but after they left, he addresses the rest of the massive assembly. He says, well, now that the trash is gone, was that just to indicate that they were substandard, or that he'd grown impatient with their arrogance? What? He didn't think much of them when they left. Now, evidently, as we read on, some of those arhats, not the ones who left, but there are still arhats in the audience. So that adds a different perspective too. Anyway, besides that whole drama, and I mention it because it's kind of significant when we get to this round of questions from the different senior students, you know, like Manjushri or Shariputra or so on. But he's also done something quite different here that I don't remember reading in any other sutra, where, you know, that thing about the tuft of hair between his eyes and the ray of light? Basically, what the story is telling us is that he gave everyone, no matter what their level, right, monk, non-monk, man, woman, child, devas, so on and so forth, lay people, gave them all a glimpse. This is what Buddhahood looks like. That would really be amazing, wouldn't it? What a thing to do. So now he's really got their attention. They're rapt. They want to know. But over and over again, and I've pointed it out as we've been going through this, there's this round of, well, where's my prediction? Where's my prediction? Well, he did, this was the way he was teaching. So in a way, you can't fault everyone for saying, well, where's my guarantee, in other words, that doing this, they haven't even heard the new teaching yet, and they're all clamoring for, you know, predict my Buddhahood. And the interesting thing is that when Shakyamuni predicts their Buddhahood, he always says sometime in the future. He still lays it right back on them, as he always has from the start. Now, if you've been reading many other sutras, or even just reading this sutra, at some point you got to ask yourself, wait a minute, we're Lotus Sutra Buddhists. Of course, we have the benefit of our mentor Nichiren and more modern thinking. We have our capacities are much greater than 27 centuries ago. So get a little tired of this question, because we know it's innate. And Shakyamuni's been teaching this. It's not the first time he's addressed his students as understanding that Buddhahood comes from within, but they still see it as something. Why do they ask for permission? Why do they want a prediction? It's like they don't quite get it, right? And this last video, this last chapter that we closed out on the Bodhisattvas of the Earth, and is that Manjushri gets up, we still have doubt. We still have doubt because you gave these predictions to all these other types of students, but you haven't really even, you've brought these Bodhisattvas up now, and you haven't had time in the time span that you've been here, right? You just were enlightened, 30 years old. Now you've been teaching for some 40 years. So you're in your 70s. Even so, how have you had time to teach all of these, I mean, sands of the Ganges River, right? There's just, you can't even see them. There's so many bodhisattvas from beneath the earth. Here you pop these people up. We've never seen them. And you claim that you've taught them all perfect enlightenment, this highest teaching. First of all, I guess the answer to where have you kept them hidden is under the earth. But you just, we don't get it because you're just not that old. There's no way you had time to train all these people. We've been following you for decades and we're not there. So when did you have time to do this? We're starting to wonder, are you just teasing us? What are you doing? Of course, they don't understand in the skillful means this thing with the time, right? Because if you understand, like the lotus flower, that these bodhisattvas from beneath the earth are future bodhisattvas coming from this process of life on the earth, right? Seeds are planted, like the lotus, and these future bodhisattvas will come. And of course, because they're future bodhisattvas, they will have had the benefit of this teaching of the Dharma, been around for a long time. That is how Shakyamuni Buddha has trained these bodhisattvas in the future. That's you and I, right? I pointed that out before. So now, obviously, this whole assembly has been, whether it's been following Shakyamuni from day one, some 42 years, or somewhere along the way joined in, they still have this notion that Shakyamuni is Buddha. Well, all of us are Buddha. All life is Buddha. The engine of life is Buddha. The only difference between that truth and our awakening of it is that we have a sentient mind to experience it. That experience is the Dharma. The teachings are about experiencing the experience, right? Getting to the experience. How do you condition your mind, your samsaric mind, to open that window that's already, to see what's already there and obvious, that the very material of the universe is the material we are made of. The Buddha-ness is, it's not just a DNA strand, it's the very energy, the very sustenance that we are manufactured, instantiated from. Just like everything, but with a sentient mind, big caveat, we can witness it. We not only can witness it, we can influence it to stay our primary experience, to stay aware, to see clearly, yes, this is life, and I'm experiencing it moment to moment to moment, just like everything is. What an amazing thing. That realization is what liberates us from our constant cravings and clingings of identifying, I'm here, by ownership of stuff. Validation. You don't need the validation. You validate. Do you see? It's a paradigm shift in the mind. So it doesn't come to you. It's not bequeathed to you. You don't have to have permission. You don't have to have some guy predict it for you. It's already there. Just do it. Just awaken it, right? But at that time, nobody was really, they just weren't getting that little final step, right? So 16th chapter. Hello. The lifespan of the Tathagata. So this chapter is basically Shakyamuni saying, okay, this is what you guys think, that I'm a guy and I'm Buddha and all Buddha will come from me. What you don't understand, what I just said without repeating myself, Buddha is you. You just need to realize it. So here we go. Thereupon the Buddha addressed the Bodhisattvas and the entire great assembly, saying, O sons of virtuous family, which is basically, this is in volume 2 of Buddhism Reference, by the way. We hear this a lot, sons of good family, sons and daughters of virtuous family. This saying is really about people who've committed to living their life within the Eightfold Noble Path, you know, living their life correctly, good behavior, and more to the point, to bodhisattvas, good students of Buddhism, yeah? You should believe the true words of the Tathagata. So you know this is going to be rattling because the first thing out of his mouth is, I'm not lying. What I'm about to drop here, it's the real. Okay. He says, you should believe the Tathagata's true words. Now, it's interesting that he would say Tathagata because he's already, and he's done this throughout, identifying that what he's saying is from the Tathagata, not Siddhartha. He's made a very strong distinction throughout his teachings. Although he adopts like first person, when he says, Tathagata says, he's saying first person as an enlightened Buddha-ness mind coursing through samsara, because he's actually a bodhisattva, right? We understand that, right? A samsaric being is a samsaric being. Buddha is in the mind. So do we operate with our monkey mind or with our Buddha mind? That's the paradigm shift, right? So he's saying, when I'm talking through my Buddha mind, the Tathagata mind, there is no falsities there. There is not even the capacity for it. It's clear, honest, real reporting, communication. Then the great assembly of bodhisattvas, headed by Maitreya, addressed the Buddha with their palms pressed together, saying, O Bhagavat, we entreat you to explain it. We will accept the Buddha's words. After they had spoken in this way three times, right, the formal, ask the question three different ways to make sure you're sincere and you know what you're asking. They again said, we entreat you to explain it. We will accept the Buddha's words. Then the Bhagavat, realizing that the Bodhisattvas continued to entreat him after those three times, addressed them saying, listen carefully to the Tathagata's secret and transcendent power. Right? I'm not speaking to you as Shakyamuni. I'm not speaking to you as Siddhartha Gautama. I'm speaking to you as a human vessel of communication for Buddha-ness, from Tathagata-ness, yeah? The devas, humans, and asuras in all the worlds all think that the present Buddha, Shakyamuni, left the palace of the Sakyas, sat on the terrace of enlightenment, not far from the city of Gaya, and attained highest complete enlightenment. Now, even if you take that sentence apart, you'll see the division in it. You think that the present Buddha, Shakyamuni, went to this place and attained enlightenment. Well, what does a Buddha need to attain enlightenment for? See the labeling? It's confusing. I suspect that the translation is partly to blame for this, but still, the conundrum, yeah? Buddha does not need to attain enlightenment. It is enlightenment. So he's already messing with the labeling and so forth, right? But you might not catch that. However, O sons of virtuous family, immeasurable, limitless, hundreds of thousands of myriads of kotas, of nayutas, of kalpas have passed since I, and that's the confusing language, right, actually attained Buddhahood. Now, again, he's speaking as the vessel of Buddhahood because it's unprecedented. No one else has attained this. But for our modern reading, it would probably benefit us to read it as it has been all this time has passed since the Tathagata has been, what, accessible, available in reality? I mean, it's a truth. But who cares about a truth unless there's a mind to perceive it? See, this is the conundrum. This is why he's speaking in the first person, right? A tree doesn't care about the truth. It just does what it does. Do you see? It's just a sentient mind that has this obsession, which is the reason we need to realize this. Because without realizing it, we're busily trying to collect something to validate our existence. When our existence, the engine of life, is implicit, it's been there all along. We're just not looking. It's interesting, isn't it? Suppose there were a man who ground 500 of thousands, hundreds of thousands, myriads of kotas of nayutas of incalculable, great, manifold cosmos into particles. Here we go. While passing through 500,000 of myriads of kotas of nayutas of incalculable lands to the east, he dropped just a single particle. And in this way, he continued to drop the particles as he went toward the east until they were all gone. Already mind blown. We can't conceive of numbers that huge, right? O sons of virtual family, what do you think about this? Well, I think it's crazy, but okay, go on. Can all of these worlds be calculated or not? Can you come up with a number? Oh, sure, Google, right? Can one imagine all of these worlds, calculate, and know their number or not? No, it's just no. I mean, you're starting with abstracts, right? Bodhisattva Maitreya and the others together address the Buddha, saying, "O Bhagavat, these worlds are immeasurable, limitless, incalculable, and beyond our powers of conception." Still are. Even all the Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, with their knowledge free from corruption, are not able to comprehend them or know their number. Although we abide in the stage of non-retrogression, we cannot understand it. O Bhagavat, such worlds as these are incalculable and limitless. Okay, you're paying attention. Good. Then the Buddha addressed the assembly of the great bodhisattvas, saying, "O sons of virtuous family, I will now explain it clearly to you. Suppose all these worlds, whether or not a particle was left in them, were reduced to particles. And each particle represented a kalpa, that wonderfully huge amount of time, which itself has no number. The period of time since I became a Buddha would exceed this by hundreds of thousands of myriads of kotas of nayutas of incalculable kalpas. Since then, I have constantly been residing in the Saha world, teaching the Dharma and inspiring sentient beings." Holy crap, what is he saying? He's getting pretty specific now, even though the time is an abstract that's incomprehensible. Basically, when we read things like time without beginning, this is the kind of time scope he's addressing. And he's saying, conceive of all time as you, beyond what you can measure, right? And he's saying Buddha. I know he's saying I, but they're still attached to that he is Buddha thing. So he's taking that apart. And he's saying, I, the I that you see as Buddha. And he knows what he's doing, because Maitreya has basically submitted to him that you, Shakyamuni, not Buddha, has only been here 70 years, or 72, or whatever it was. You've only been here 70 years. And what Shakyamuni is telling him is, yeah, but I, Buddha, my Tathagata, the Buddha-ness that you've labeled me with, has been here since time immemorial, time without beginning. See how he's starting to disassemble that? And in that time, I've constantly been teaching the Dharma, not me, Shakyamuni, addressing Manjushri's question directly. It wasn't me that taught all these bodhisattvas. It was Tathagata that taught all these bodhisattvas. In other words, this nature, which is inherent in all phenomena, has been there to inculcate this realization whenever it's called upon. It needs to be called upon, but it's always been there. Right? It's implicit in the story as he develops it. Let's go on. I have also been leading and benefiting sentient beings in incalculable hundreds of thousands of myriads of kotas of nayutas of other worlds. And since this is the cosmic, the universal aspect, right? That when you look into the skies, whatever other worlds, they all are of the same nature. This is massive, right? O sons of virtuous family, during this interim, I explained about the Buddha Dipamkara and others, right? These emanations, if you will, imaginings, these mental constructions of Shakyamuni. Furthermore, I also said that they had entered Parinirvana. They're extinct. I have explained such things through skillful means. O sons of virtuous family, if any sentient being comes to me, I perceive the dullness or sharpness of his resolve and other faculties with my Buddha eye. Not my Shakyamuni eye, my Buddha eye. According to the way I should bring them to the path, I myself proclaim different names and lifespans in various places. Ooh. So you keep assigning these lifespans to me, Shakyamuni, when in fact I'm creating personages to be placeholders for certain times and certain histories and certain teachings and certain capacities. Woo, that's a biggie. And unless you were thinking this way and knew this from our studies, you'll go right past it, right? It isn't that articulated here, but it's there. In each case, I have also clearly stated that I would enter Parinirvana. Through various skillful means, I have explained subtle teachings and have made the sentient beings rejoice. Whatever their need was to get on the path at the level that they could, I assisted them. I facilitated that for them. That doesn't mean they reach full enlightenment, but they're on the path and they've made great gains. That explains all of his teachings, right? Not only in Shakyamuni's lifetime, but theoretically throughout all time. The Buddhaness is the eye of understanding, which, as I've already talked about briefly, you don't have to be a Buddhist to get insights in life. But being a Buddhist, you start to put them together into a cohesive whole, and that is huge. That is not naturally our tendencies. We get an insight and we run with it until we exhaust it, and then we're right back in samsara, right? That's our habit. All right. O sons of a virtuous family, to those beings who the Tathagata perceives as taking pleasure in the inferior teachings, who have few qualities and grave defilements, they're really stuck in the cravings and avarice and clinging of samsara. He teaches that the Buddha attained highest complete enlightenment after he renounced household life in his young age. Right? You're going to have to let this all go. You got to go live in a monastery. You got to stop thinking about girls and boys and blah, 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 blah. You got to start getting serious about your enlightenment. Okay. Right? The early teachings. However, it has been a very long time indeed since I attained Buddhahood. I give such an explanation only to lead and inspire the sentient beings to enter the Buddha path through skillful means. Now he's explained his entire 42-year history of teachings as inferior, as preparatory, to try to slowly lift the capacities of everyone until this day. He's made it abundantly clear right here, hasn't he? O sons of a virtuous family, the sutras that the Tathagata has expounded are all to save sentient beings. They all have the same motivation. Attitude and intent, right? Whether the Tathagata teaches about himself or others, whether he reveals his form or that of others, whether he shows his acts or those of others, everything he says is true, never false. Why is this? Because the Tathagata perceives all the marks of the triple world as they really are, right? That's the clarity of understanding the engine of life. Through that lens, everything is in its order. No need for grasping and clinging, right? That there is no birth and death. There is only moment to moment to moment instantiation of the engine of life through the filters of karma and so on and so forth. There is no coming or going. That there is also no existence nor extinction in the world, truth or falsehoods, sameness or difference. The Tathagata does not view the triple world as sentient beings in the triple world see it. The Tathagata perceives such things clearly and without mistakes. So this is probably the most profound statement so far. And it's how it could not serve to confuse the assembly, I'm not sure. Because it's hard to conceive of, even to you and I, isn't it? And I've talked about this in so many ways. That when we talk about fusing with the mandala, perceiving energy. You know, it's like when we perceive light from a flashlight or anything, photons, you know what photons are, just little quanta of energy. We see energy. We see it as light, but you ever see a really hot tarmac, like on a road on a hot summer day, and you see little waves in the air? It almost looks like you could grab them, but they're like distortions, just heat. You're seeing heat rise off of the road, right? It's not light. Well, it's a reflection of light. That's how you see. But anyway, it's not photons itself. It's energy. You're seeing energy. The transfer of heat, it is energy. Just like photons. It's just a different, slightly different form, slightly different manifestation, yeah? Now, extend that, you know this, so extend that seeing, quote unquote, to trees, to you and me. We're just in the same way, although with incalculable variety, forms of energy amalgamated into something. But that's the whole contention. The thing is a perception of the samsaric mind. The Buddha mind understands that this is all happening moment to moment, energies instantiating. Yeah, our skandhas, our I consciousness, one of the first skandhas, it isn't trained to do that. It's trained samsarically to see solidity. But the Buddha mind sees the packets of energy. Doesn't mean you go blind. I'm just saying that there's a different understanding of what is being seen. Let me say it like that. This is some of what we experience when we fuse with the mandala. When you see the mandala do little weird things as you're chanting intently. Yeah, that's the Buddha mind seeing reality, a reality you're not accustomed to seeing. Because we like to permanentize everything, you know? It's subtle, but oh man, do you see it when you see it. And this is exactly what he's talking about here. I'm going to read this paragraph again so you can hear it. Because the Tathagata perceives all the marks of the triple world as they really are, that there is no birth and death, coming or going, that there is no existence or extinction in the world, truth or falsehood, sameness or difference. There is just the activity constantly happening of instantiating these potentials. And we can witness that instantiation from moment to moment to moment to moment. But every moment, it's a new instantiation. It's not the same thing existing, right? It is being, which is not an existing, because existing imposes a permanence, right? Whereas being is a, it can be seen as a moment-to-moment action happening, yeah? Again, it's subtle, but it's very important. Since sentient beings have various natures, desires, behaviors, thoughts, and distinctions, right? Karma. We all subtly have billions and billions of different little filters, some very similar, some not so much. The Tathagata, wanting to cause them to plant roots of good merit, start solidifying your mind of Buddha-ness and letting go of the mind of discriminations and categorizing and the big old database. He explains various, he has explained various teachings through a variety of examples, explanations, and illustrations. It's a guy to get the mind working on a different perspective, yeah? He has not desisted from doing Buddha acts, even for a single moment, and in this way, it has been an extremely long time since I attained Buddhahood. My lifespan is immeasurable and incalculable. Now, is he talking about Shakyamuni? No. He's talking about the lifespan of Tathagata, of Buddha-ness, yeah? I abide forever without entering Parinirvana. As long as there's a cosmos, Buddha-ness is there. Buddha-ness is something to be discovered in yourself. Bring it forth in your own mind, because that's where it is. You're not going to find it in a river or a stream, in that guy's pocket, or in a book. It's already built in. You just need to learn to see it. Why is this? Because the Buddha abides a long time in this world. Those who have few qualities do not plant roots of good merit, acquire poor and superficial characteristics or characters, are attached to the desires of the five senses, the skandhas, and enter into the web of illusions and false views. Right? If they see the Tathagata always existing without extinction, they then become proud, self-willed, and negligent. Right? Well, I can always fix it. Look, I'll go talk to Buddha if things get really rough. Or like the Arhats that left. Yeah, we've heard this before. And if we haven't, we'll just come back and, right? Because Buddha's this guy. But it's not. So if they see the Tathagata, they imagine that the Tathagata is this entity outside themselves, in the world, abiding in the world. Then what do they have to worry, right? What do they have to worry about hunting food for their family if there's a grocery store there all the time? I'll just get it when I need it, right? But if you knew that food came from your efforts in your mind, you'd set to work on it, wouldn't you? If they see the Tathagata always existing, they become proud, blah, blah, blah. The thought that the Tathagata, or the Buddha, is difficult to meet, and that he is not to be, or that he is to be respected, cannot awaken in them. Right? They can't be bothered to make the effort. That is why the Tathagata teaches through skillful means, saying, "O monks, you should know that the appearance of the Buddhas in the world is very difficult to encounter." Oh, okay. So we better pay attention, right? But still, he's abiding here. Unless he teaches that he's not only hard to find, but he's not going to be around. There's an additional exegesis to better get this for myself, right? Why is this? Because some of those with little merit may not see the Buddha during the passage of immeasurable hundreds of thousands of myriads of kodas of kalpas. For this reason, I say, oh monks, it is difficult to meet the Tathagata. Which is why he says, and Nichiren reminds us, single-mindedly meet the Tathagata, because the Tathagata is in your mind. Open your Gohanzon door and meet Buddha. Escape, liberate yourself from samsara. Hearing such words, the thought that is very difficult to meet the Tathagata will certainly awaken in these sentient beings. Longing and yearning for the Buddha, they will plant good roots of good merit, practice assiduously. For this reason, although the Tathagata does not really pass into extinction, he nevertheless says he does. Now that's another tricky statement, isn't it? The capacity for Buddha-ness is always, it's in every sentient being, so it's always there. But awakening to it, that takes personal effort. So because they're still identifying Tathagata with Shakyamuni, he's teaching that I'm not going to be here, so your anchor, your samsaric attachment clinging to me is all for naught. Stop doing that. Work on Buddha now. Furthermore, O sons of virtuous family, the teaching of all the Buddha Tathagatas is exactly like this. All of them. All of us. It is entirely true, never false, all for the sake of saving sentient beings. Saving. I don't like that word. Liberating sentient beings. Sentient minds. There are a lot of ways I would change these translations. Maybe I'll make a Sylvain Chamberlain translation of the Lotus Sutra sometime. I need your support. Suppose there were an excellent doctor. He is wise, knowledgeable, his prescriptions are effective, and he has skillfully cured a variety of diseases. This man has many sons, say 10, 20, or even 100 in number. For some reason, he has to go off, far off to another country. And while he's away, his children, whom he has left behind, drink some poison. The poison starts to take effect, and they roll around on the ground in agony. At this moment, their father returns home. Some of the children who have taken the poison are delirious, while others are not. Seeing their father in the distance, they all rejoice greatly and, kneeling respectfully, address him, saying, "It is good that you have returned safely. In our ignorance, we took this poison by mistake. We entreat you to cure and save us and restore us to life." Seeing his children suffering in this way, the father searches for beneficial herbs possessed of good color, aroma, and flavor, according to the medical manual. Blending them together after grinding and sifting, he gives the mixture to his children and says, "This is an extremely beneficial medicine with good color, aroma, and flavor. All of you, take it. It will quickly remove your pain, and you will never be afflicted again." Wow, oh yeah, hand it over. Then the children who have not become delirious see this beneficial medicine of good color aroma and immediately take it. The affliction is completely removed and they're cured. The remaining children, those who are delirious, seeing their father coming to them, rejoice and ask him to seek a cure for their illness. Although he offers them the medicine, they won't take it. Why? The poison has so deeply penetrated them that they've become delirious. They do not think that the medicine with good color and aroma is good. They doubt the father. The father thinks, "These children are to be pitied. The poison has completely warped their minds. Although they rejoice upon seeing me and sought a cure, they won't take this beneficial medicine. I will now cause them to take this medicine through skillful means." You see what this analogy is talking about, right? He's still working on them, trying to get them to understand skillful means, how I, Shakyamuni, have taught the path to the Dharma, but I am not the Dharma. I'm a teacher of the Dharma. The Dharma, hello, it's in you. Take this lesson to execute your own cure, in essence. You liberate your mind. I can't do it. I can only show you not only a path to get there, skillful means for you to make your own path to get there, and extol the benefits of this achievement. But you have to take the medicine. You have to do it. Then he says to them, "You should know that I am now old and feeble, close to death. I will now leave this beneficial medicine here." Oh, I'll put it right over here. "You should take it. Do not worry about not recovering." Having left these instructions, he goes off to another country and sends a messenger back home to tell them, "Your father has already died." Oh. So what are they doubting now? He's dead. He's gone. Hearing that their father is dead, the children become very distressed and think, "If our father had lived, he would have taken pity on us and protected us, but now, abandoning us, he has died in a distant country. That jerk." Yeah. But now they're faced with the consequences of their own decisions. They can't blame it on dear old dad. They now consider themselves orphans, having no one to rely upon or blame. Through constant grieving, their minds become clear. And only then do they realize that the medicine has fine color, aroma, and flavor. They immediately take it and the poison is completely driven out. Right? They had to be desperately on their own to finally take responsibility for themselves. They took the medicine and they were cured. The father, hearing that all his children have completely recovered, immediately returns and makes his appearance. What? The Buddha then asked the Bodhisattvas, O sons of a virtuous family, do you think there is anyone who would say that this good doctor is guilty of lying? The Bodhisattvas replied, No, we do not, O Bhagava. We understand why he did what he did. He didn't lie with intention to lie, right? He set up a condition where his deluded children would awaken themselves. That's the lesson. The Buddha said, I am just like this. Since I became a Buddha, immeasurable, limitless, hundreds of thousands of myriads of kotas, of nayutas, of incalculable kalpas have passed. Though for the sake of sentient beings, I use skillful means and say that I will enter parinirvana. There is no one who could rightly say that I am guilty of falsehood. Thereupon the Bhagavat, wanting to elaborate on the meaning of this further, spoke these verses, and have gone on really long today, but this is a core teaching of this Lotus Sutra. This is so much the core that this is what Nichiren is constantly referring to. This probably one of Nichiren's big renge moments, yeah, not only for himself but for his compassion for all other sentient beings. Man, it's right here. Yeah? Anyway, I've gone on a bit along today, but I appreciate, especially if you've gone all the way to the end of this, I hope that you do that. I hope I'm engaging enough that you stick with these videos. There's so much information in them, and your practice is so precious to me and to you and to everyone, especially in this samsaric Mapo age that we live in. The discord is, we have a lot to influence, and it requires our strength of conviction in our practice. Yeah. So for that, I congratulate you. I'm grateful for you. And if you can even just like and subscribe, it supports and grows this propagation effort, this Sangha. Yeah. Anything else you can do, from buying an ebook to Patreon and PayPal, it supports this resource so that I can create more books, maybe do a translation. What do you think of that, by the way? Maybe that's just, there's so many translations out there, but I think my translation would be quite unique. Adaptation, maybe I should call it. I don't know. What do you think? I really want to hear from you. And it doesn't have to be in a comment on YouTube. It could be an email, tlksylvain@gmail.com. Yeah? In the meantime, please be kind to yourself and take care of your health. Kind to those around you. Love your life. Savor your practice. And I'll see you in the next one. Okay? All right. Bye for now.